And you are listening to Living Room on KPFA 94.1 FM and kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Is civil society everything that it's cracked up to be? Is public opinion the product more of autonomous decisions or of carefully placed propaganda? How encouraged should we be by the massive anti-war demonstrations around the world in early 2003? Important questions, and we'll take all of them up in the context of a key left thinker named Antonio Gramsci. Born in Italy in 1891, Gramsci grew up to resist both the fascist movement personified by Mussolini, as well as the USSR's growing authoritarianism under Stalin. Jailed by Mussolini in 1926, Gramsci wrote most of his important work in prison, where he eventually died at the tender age of 46. The important work in prison I just mentioned is contained in a series of notebooks published many years after Gramsci's death. These lengthy documents are being translated into English in a prolonged kind of heroic effort by a Gramsci expert named Joseph Buttigieg. Buttigieg is an English professor at the University of Notre Dame. He spent many years not just translating, but editing and studying and teaching Antonio Gramsci, and he'll join us live a little later in the show. We start today with Joseph Buttigieg giving a talk on Gramsci at the recent Marxism in the World Stage Conference at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Buttigieg began by referring to a well-known author from India.
I'm going to start by referring to an article which I actually like a lot. So although I'm going to unfold the problem out of it, the intent is not to criticize the article, because the article was written at a very specific moment and for a very specific reason. And I'm referring to an article written by the renowned Indian writer and activist Arundhati Roy. This appeared on 2nd April 2003, in other words, beginning of the war, in the English daily, The Guardian. It was entitled Mesopotamia, Babylon, the Tigris and Euphrates. And if you can find it, I recommend it. It's a tour de force of concise, charged rhetoric. I'm going to talk about a problem, or rather I'm going to bring out a problem out of it for other reasons that would become clear. Anyway, in this article, she pointed out, after excoriating Bush and Blair and so on, she pointed out that there is a difference, and one must be insistent on it, the difference between the governments of the Anglo-American coalition and the people that those governments govern. The multitudes who took to the streets all across the world in vigorous opposition to the war represented, in Roy's words, and I quote her, the most spectacular display of public morality ever seen. She then went on to heap special praise on the anti-war movement in the United States, and I quote her. She said, most courageous of all are the hundreds of thousands of American people on the streets of America's great cities. In fact, I'm still quoting her, the fact is that the only institution in the world today that is more powerful than the American government is American civil society. American citizens have a huge responsibility riding on their shoulders. How can we not salute and support those who not only acknowledge but act upon that responsibility? They are our allies and our friends. And then she develops this into a very important emphasis on the need not to have a kind of racism in reverse. In other words, so that anti-Americanism becomes the analog to... Anyway, that's not where I want to go with it. But I want to make parenthetically an observation. And that is that there has been, in the wake of the totally unexpected enthusiasm sort of participation in the anti-war movement, there's been a tendency to exaggerate it somewhat in the United States. I'm not saying, you know, that the millions of people who marched in Europe were not staggering in their size. But, for example, in the United States, if you look at what happened on February 15th, that's the day in which there were 2 million people or more in Rome, more than a million in London and so on. The total number of people that protested in the United States on that day, if you add them all up, you know, was less than 1 million people. Okay, so if London had 1 million, the United States with a population that is five times as big as the UK, there would have had to have a similar situation, about 5 million people marching. The Democratic Party, you know, might have been shamed at that point to do something. But anyway, that's one point. But my point is different. And that is, what about this question of civil society? So Roy says, you know, civil society is the only institution in the world today more powerful than the American government. Would a Bush defeat, for example, in the 2004 elections vindicate this assertion? I think it's difficult to pin down exactly why Roy has pinned, to figure out exactly why Roy has pinned her hopes on American civil society as an antidote to the Bush administration's destructive policies. Indeed, while the rest of her article is as lucid as it is trenchant, it is not at all clear in the end what she means by civil society. The context, of course, suggests that she is equating civil society with the people as opposed to the government. And in this respect, she may be echoing certain theorists for whom civil society means more or less the same thing as not simply the people as opposed to the government, but an ensemble of popular progressive oppositional movements not formally or necessarily affiliated with a specific political party. And it is this issue that I want to bring to discussion today. This is the meaning that is attached to the term global civil society, particularly, just to give you a concrete example, by the researchers that are associated with the London School of Economics Center for Civil Society. These are the people who also publish the Global Society yearbook. In the opening chapter of the 2003 yearbook, the editors literally identify the anti-Iraq war movement with global civil society. They refer to the massive protests by millions of people all across the world as, and I quote, the mobilization of global civil society. In the same chapter, they also write about the normative implications of the concept of civil society. One of which, they say, one of the normative implications is finding and giving voice to those affected by old, new, and emerging inequities in the broadest sense, and providing a political and social platform for such voices to be heard. Now, seen in this light, to go back briefly to Roy's remark would simply be an affirmation of a laudable, albeit somewhat overly optimistic, hope that popular dissent could prove strong enough to overwhelm the massive power of the US government when the US government misuses its power. The broader question, however, is whether there is anything to be gained in political theory, as well as in political strategy, by the effort of researchers and activists to so drastically shift the meaning of the term civil society. It would appear at first sight that the addition of global to civil society is felicitous, for it takes into account the complex relations among societies that are today more intertwined than ever before and are governed by regimes whose policies and actions have consequences that are increasingly trans and cross-national in character. The motivation may be commendable, and especially more so when one takes into account the intent to invigorate civil society so that it would withstand the overbearing and invasive power of the state and the market. This whole idea, actually, of using the term in this way owes a lot to the reaction and the reflection on what happened in the period leading to 1989. On the one hand, in Eastern Europe, you have the term circulating in Poland and other places, then Czechoslovakia, and it was taken to be a term referring to two related phenomena. One is the state ran entirely on the basis of coercion. So we have no civil society means we we are run by coercion. But also it had the other side to it, that we are civil society who are protesting and we overthrow the regime. Because we not only do not give it our consensus, but we are formulating, one could call, a counter-view, a counter-hegemony, and so on. At any rate, but at the same time, or roughly coincident with this, you have in Latin America a number of movements aiming for democratization who are also using the term, and perhaps the Latin Americans with more direct allusion to Gramsci, although Gramsci was very much also in the air, as it were. Now, the other consequence of this is that for some theorists who, you recall, 1989, 1990, were in a desperate, almost obscene rush to denounce any association they had with Marxism, but say we're still oppositional, came up with the notion, well, maybe civil society would be our oppositional label. And you will find this, and I don't mean to oversimplify, because this is an enormous study I'm going to refer to that is very sophisticated, it's very thorough, but totally, in my view, flawed. And this is Cohen and Arato's book on civil society, which is a massive tome, whose whole purpose is to persuade us that the age of parties is gone, the age of Marxism is gone, but there is this wonderful thing called civil society, which is like a magic formula. Now we have civil society, and you'll see, we'll succeed in whatever oppositional project we're engaged in. Okay, I say, however, that the equating of civil society, global or otherwise, with popular oppositional movement, and this is the thesis I'd like to develop, is very likely to result in an oversimplification of the immensely intricate web of interdependent relations between society, or if you prefer, the people, and government, or if you prefer, the state. And it would also, in my view, or is likely, in my view, to result in a reductive understanding of the myriad connections and divergences among the various elements that constitute civil society itself. It is also likely, and this probably would be the worst thing, it is also likely to result in misdiagnoses of the operations of power and of the resilience of the very forces that one wants to combat. One of the theoretical sources, now this is the oddity, one of the theoretical sources of the London School of Economics group is precisely the work of Antonio Gramsci. A succinct account of how they read Gramsci is provided in the 2001, that's the very first yearbook. They write, "Gramsci, unlike Marx and Hegel," I'm quoting them, "divorces the notion of civil society from economic interactions." Where? "He views civil society as consisting of cultural institutions, notably the church, but also schools, associations, trade unions, and other cultural institutions." I'm still quoting them. Gramsci is ambiguous about this civil society of his. On the one hand, it is through this cultural superstructure that the bourgeois class imposes its hegemony, using it to keep the working class in its place. On the other hand, it is a kind of wedge between the state and the class-structured economy, which has the revolutionary potential of dislodging the bourgeoisie. End of quote. One is struck by the observation, Gramsci is ambiguous about this civil society of his. What the authors find ambiguous, namely that civil society is simultaneously the terrain of hegemony and of opposition to the hegemony, is precisely Gramsci's main contribution to political theory. Let me give you a brief quotation from Notebook 13. Gramsci writes, "What does state mean? Is it just the state apparatus, that is what the liberals call government, or the whole of organized civil society? Or is it the dialectical unity between government power and civil society?" The question obviously rhetorical, and the answer is the latter. Civil society in Gramsci must be understood as two-sided. In order for the ruling classes to be hegemonic, that is to rule by consent, though always holding their force in reserve, they must allow for a space of non-interference, or at least seeming non-interference by the state. It is within this sphere, Benedetto just explained this more eloquently than I can, that ideas circulate and worldviews are formed freely, so that when these views and ideas endorse the existing political arrangement, they do so more or less spontaneously and thus give ethical legitimacy to it. But of course, the dominant classes are not passive observers of the goings-on in civil society or in institutions. The dominant classes, Gramsci repeats over and over again, lead society in certain directions. Sure, dissent is possible. But first, prior to that, I think we should concentrate on what makes the hegemony so difficult to challenge successfully. Gramsci's work in prison stems in large measure from the conviction, following defeat, by the way, that it is essential first and foremost to understand the sources of power, their resilience, and so on. This is an aspect of his work that needs to be imitated more urgently than ever. Whereas most progressive thinking has focused on the possibilities of counter-hegemonic action, which in my view often leads to disillusionment. Okay? Now, let me quote first of all a passage in which Gramsci shows that in fact there is constant interaction between political and civil society. This is Gramsci. What is called public opinion is tightly connected to political hegemony. In other words, it is the point of contact, public opinion, the point of contact between civil society and political society, between consent and force. When the state wants to embark on an action that is not popular, it starts to create in advance the public opinion that is required. In other words, it organizes and centralizes certain elements of civil society. History of public opinion. Naturally, elements of public opinion have always existed, even in the Asiatic satrapies. But public opinion as we think of it today was born on the eve of the collapse of the absolute state. That is, during the period when the new bourgeois class was engaged in the struggle for political hegemony and the conquest of power. That was the modern state. Public opinion, to conclude this note by Gramsci, is the political content of the public's political will, which can be dissentient. Therefore, there is a struggle for the monopoly of the organs of public opinion. Newspapers, political parties, parliament, so that only one force would mold public opinion and hence the political will of the nation, while reducing the dissenters to individual and disconnected specks of dust. That's Gramsci. So I want to use that to make two basic points. Number one, the separation of the two spheres is not useful for analysis or for anything. Secondly, that in fact, this is indicative already of a phenomenon we comment in everyday life, but we don't carry in theory. Who owns the organs of public opinion? Sure, there are independent organs of public opinion, but you can hardly say the playing field is level, right? I mean, when you look at, you know, the general scene. Finally, there is another element that I think any discussion of civil society informed by Gramsci should examine. Gramsci talks here and there in the notebooks about what I would summarize as the corruption of civil society. And I think if you look at the way in which opinion is formed and the way in which there is an effort to monopolize, not only, by the way, not only the big media, you know, Fox and whatever, but other things in civil society. For example, the way universities teach politics, for example, without being listed in Lin Cheney's list, right? There is an effort towards conformity, which is not simply making everybody think the same, but making everybody think less intelligently and less critically, so that in the end you end up with a corruption of civil society which makes the dissentient voices, as opposed to the conformist voices which lend consent, even more difficult to have an impact. And the final point is that it's very disturbing to notice that the right wing in the United States has used and appreciated the value of civil society infinitely more than the West. Now, when I was giving a version of this paper in England, you know, somebody said, well, it's very abstract. Isn't it not very abstract? If we were all passing emails to each other right before the war, this is such a corrupt administration. Do you realize the strategic plan of the United States comes from Cheney and so on, what was called the project of the new, like a big discovery, right? And isn't this terrible? No, it's not terrible. Civil society always produces those things. Always. It's not like government sits and says, let us organize a strategic plan. It comes from experts. Gramsci talks about the experts. It comes from universities. And I found, I leave you with this anecdote, go hunt for this. This didn't start with Bush. In 1979, an organization was set up, a kind of think tank, to reverse the policy of the United States vis-a-vis Latin America. This was called the Santa Fe Commission, and they were opposed to Carter. This was civil society, and they produced a document, which if you read it today is incredible because it is exactly the policy that you will see unfold in Reagan's years. And also, very amusingly, many of the people involved who were university professors in this became involved later in Iran-Contra or in some of the most horrendous goings-on of American collusion with Guatemalan massacres and so on. Anyway, before Reagan left the presidency, they thought they prepared another one for George Bush. This one is not of any interest because Bush, with 89, had other things to concern him. But it's interesting for Gramscians because the opening pages say the biggest danger in Latin America today is Gramscism, because this Gramsci is being read and is inspiring calls for democracy and anti-dictators. But what these people don't realize is that Gramsci is a statist, so we must extirpate him. And subsequently, Americans who were given these, you know, these reports started uttering the same thing, including people like Novak in Fortune magazine, Flora Lewis in the New York Times, and so on. An operation entirely carried out in civil society.
That's Joseph Buttigieg, Notre Dame English professor, speaking at an international conference last November organized by the editors of the journal Rethinking Marxism. This show is Living Room. My name is C.S. Song. And because the talk you just heard both answered and raised some questions in my mind, I invited Joe Buttigieg to join us live today to elaborate and share more of his insights into Antonio Gramsci's ideas and what they might offer the left today. Joe is secretary of the International Gramsci Society, and he has edited and translated Prison Notebooks 1 through 5 of Gramsci in two volumes that have been published by Columbia University Press. Welcome to you, Joe.
Thank you. Pleased to be with you.
Great to have you with us. I'd like you to start by just saying a few words about Antonio Gramsci as a person. What stands out to you about this man's a personality and background?
Yeah, I suppose the first characteristic one would mention about him is his resilience. You know, Gramsci was born in 1891 in Gilardzai village in the island of Sardinia, and had a very harsh upbringing, and largely because his family was not well off at all. But somehow he managed to win a scholarship and go to the University of Turin on the mainland, which in those days, and probably even today, was the major industrial city in Italy. And that's where he started getting involved and increasingly interested in labor movements and so on and so forth. And to cut a long story short, he first belonged to the Socialist Party, And he worked very hard, both with the workers, but also for them, as it were. He worked mostly through newspapers, but also through organizing factory councils and so on. Eventually, he was a founder member of the Italian Communist Party, and had been managed to go to Moscow a few times to attend Comintern meetings. And then he was arrested in 1926 by Mussolini's fascist regime, and ended up in prison till he died. He was condemned for 20-plus years, spent the rest of his life in prison. He died before he was released. And the remarkable thing is that in spite of poor health and the most abysmal of conditions, he set himself the task of thinking and studying and writing. And during this very painful period, he produced an enormous body of work, which we now call, we've given the title to over the years, of Gramsci's Prison Notebooks. But what stands out is his resilience. You know, when he was tried by the fascist regime, the prosecutor said, we must stop this brain from thinking for at least the next 20 years. And that's exactly what they tried to do. And of course, he defied them by precisely continuing to think. And the legacy is this magnificent work of political theory and cultural analysis that we call the Prison Notebooks.
And how was he able to write as much as he did in prison and then get it out to people beyond the prison walls?
Well, he actually did not manage to get it out. The story of the survival of these notebooks is would make a fantastic novel. He managed to obtain permission to write in his cell under strict supervision. You know, they numbered the number of pages he had available to him and so on and so forth. But he wrote through a sheer self-discipline. He had access to books. The famous economist Piero Sraffa was a professor of economics at Cambridge, who was Italian, supplied Gramsci with an account that enabled him to obtain books. And he read and he studied and he wrote. As I said, his health was absolutely awful, but he stuck to it, kept on writing until about 1935. He died in 37. In 35, he suffered a horrendous setback in his already frail health. After he died, through a very convoluted set of maneuvers, his sister-in-law managed to get these enormous number of notebooks out of Italy, under the nose of Mussolini, and get them to the Soviet Union, and they were consigned to his family and also to members of the Italian Communist Party who were there, living there in exile at the time.
Antonio Gramsci wrote, well, I guess it depends on how you count them, but he wrote, by one count, 29 notebooks. And Joseph Buttigieg, who is my guest today, he has edited and translated notebooks 1 through 5, Prison Notebooks 1 through 5 of Antonio Gramsci, Volume 1, published in 1991 by Columbia University Press, covered, I believe, notebooks 1 through 3, 1 through 2 or 1 through 3?
1 through 2, yes.
1 through 2, and then 3 through 5 were part of Prison Notebooks Volume 2, that was published also by Columbia University Press in 1996. Volume 3, which you are working on now,
right,
to include notebooks 6 through 8 or 9, is
right,
due out in the summer of 2005. Antonio Gramsci's notebooks, by the way, have been called among the most remarkable documents of Western political thought. And if you know of Edward Said, the late, great Edward Said, he said the following: Joseph Buttigieg's work is a monument of scholarship and of supple, deeply sensitive translation. When his work is completed in subsequent volumes, a remarkable monument of human courage and an intellectual resourcefulness will stand forth as never before. Let's dive into some of the issues you brought up, Joe, in your talk at this conference in November. And I want to focus first on civil society. And obviously, from your remarks at that conference, Gramsci had some very strong opinions about what constituted civil society and why it was important. Why is it so important in your mind to understand civil society properly. Why isn't it okay, say, if one person defines the term one way and another person another way?
Right. Let me try and actually distinguish two ways in which you could think about it. Gramsci developed his views on civil society as he was exploring the specific ways in which modern Western societies, one would call them modern liberal democracies, work. And he conceived of the modern state as exercising power through what he called hegemony, that is, not by imposing or forcing people, not by coercion, but rather through persuasion. In other words, and this is obvious, we give our consent to the government. We do not, we are not ruled by force. However, he conceived of civil society as part of the state in general. In other words, for Gramsci, the state was made up of political society, like government, the law courts, and so on, and civil society. And there was a constant interaction between the two. But government, so to speak, derived its legitimacy from consent, and the consent was generated in civil society. Now, the other way of looking at it, which is gaining a lot of ground today, is to see civil society as something totally separate from the state. And so there have been progressive movements that regard civil society as that which stands in opposition to the state. Now, the problem with seeing it that way is that you start to imagine civil society as a totally free zone of thinking and activity, as opposed to a sphere where it is true ideas can circulate freely, but they do not circulate, as it were, on a level playing field, because political society, the government, and so on and so forth, exercise an influence on civil society, and certain interests in society support the government through civil society with means of persuasion, like, for example, their own the media, you know, the means of communication, and therefore have a greater say. So in my view, we've got to look at civil society not as opposed to the state, as our sphere of freedom as opposed to government, which is somehow the sphere of coercion on imposition, but rather we've got, like Gramsci, to see that the state is political society and civil society, and civil society is not simply a sphere of freedom, but it could also be the sphere which could be corrupted and therefore would lend legitimacy to a government which could be doing nefarious things.
And because you see many people on the left seeing civil society as independent from the state,
right,
you say that in the talk we just played, that most progressive thinking has focused on the possibility of counter-hegemonic action, which in my view, in your view, often leads to disillusionment. Tell us what you mean by that.
What I mean by that is that I believe if we harp too much on the notion of counter-hegemonic positions, we will start harboring a false optimism that we regard everything we do that is not directly conformist as somehow a threat to the current the status quo. And Gramsci actually hardly ever, in fact, I can barely think of a significant instance where he used the term counter-hegemony. Gramsci's work was devoted to understanding how hegemony worked in order to be able, therefore, to participate in this contestation in an informed way.
That's Joseph Buttigieg. He is an English professor at the University of Notre Dame, and he's on the advisory board of the journal Rethinking Marxism. He's also co-edited the book Gramsci and Education, published last year by Roman and Littlefield. I guess one question that comes to mind, Joe, is the ability of people to think outside the box if ruling involves, as you just mentioned, in large part the consent of those who are ruled, and that consent is manufactured by the media and by a number of other things that are manipulated by the dominant classes. How optimistic could Gramsci be about our ability, your and mine, any individual's or group's ability within society to really to think independently and to act independently.
Right. This is interesting because, you know, one of the phrases, as it were, or mottos associated with Gramsci is a kind of slogan he derived from another intellectual, Romain Rolland, which went pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will. And what he meant by stressing that, what he meant to stress by that, was that, look, the odds are stacked against oppositional thinking. And it is only by virtue of, let's say, will, by wanting to, by striving to, does one oppose the status quo. The problem that Gramsci was really worried about was that if you abandon pessimism, you will end up having a very poor analysis, a facile view of who your opposition is.
I see. You also spoke in your remarks of a corruption of civil society in the form of an effort toward conformity, things you've been alluding to as we've been chatting live. And you see this as being played out in, among other places, this country's universities. Elaborate on that.
Well, I see it played out in the universities, but of course, as I think I was trying to point out, this was only a symptom of a larger phenomenon. In other words, that we have around us many, many examples of outrageous ideas, totally untenable views, circulating as if they were respectable, you know. But anyway, to talk specifically about the universities have traditionally been seen as the arenas of free and independent inquiry. Whereas, in fact, as we are seeing, the universities are under enormous amounts of pressure to conform. You made an allusion earlier to, for example, Edward Said. You know, there was a hearing in Congress a couple of months ago in which people objected to the fact that so-called anti-American ideas fostered by Said are now rampant in universities. And therefore, the argument went, we should make sure to cut all federal funds to those programs where these ideas are circulating. Well, first of all, the corruption occurs in saying things like that Said had an anti-American mentality. I mean, Said was a critic who criticized the impoverishment of civil society and human rights in the Arab world as much as he criticized the problems of American foreign policy. But you see, what gets transmitted here is a pressure and an association of an idea that this is anti-American. And in the universities, this has resonance. Administrators start getting afraid of loss of funds. Faculty start getting anxious about whether they will get tenure or not. And therefore, what passes on the surface as an arena of freedom and of free independent thought, in fact, is an arena where thought is conditioned by these threats and fears and so on.
You mentioned in your conference remarks Lynn Cheney's list. Lynn Cheney obviously being the wife of Dick Cheney. That was what? Something, a list compiled by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, which board member Lynn Cheney co-founded. And that was a list
with the Lieberman, I should add.
Right.
Yeah.
And it compiled a list of over 40 scholars across the country who the organization deemed unpatriotic. That was released in late 2001.
Precisely. And this is part of the corruption I've been mentioning, because it then becomes common sense among some people that these professors that they listed were actually ranting and raving against the United States, and nothing of the sort was going on. These were people who were saying we ought to re-examine our relation with the world. It is not an accident that certain events took place. And you see, this is the corruption of thought, that instead of thinking and seeing what the other argument is, you stifle it by misrepresenting it.
We've already started to address this, but the right and civil society, rightist elements, conservative, reactionary elements in this country, they, according to you, have used the idea of civil society or manipulated it or understood it, perhaps, better than the left in this country.
That's right, or at least they have succeeded in their strategy of generating certain forms of thinking to civil society, a strategy that has been much more effective. This is very amusing because, I mean, amusing and worrisome. In right-wing books, specifically, for example, in one of Rush Limbaugh's book, it was called, I believe, I Told You So, or something like that, and Buchanan's book, which was about the demise or the death of the West, I think it was called, both of them go on and on about how dangerous Gramsci is and how the left is inspired by Gramsci to go and corrupt society by undermining things like family and all kinds of good values. And then they say, well, Gramsci theorized the march through the institutions. And so the United States could fall apart as these sort of, I don't know, termites, I guess, undermine it. Hmm. Well, the truth of the matter, of course, is that nobody has been more masterful at constructing certain views. Nobody's been as successful as the right wing. All one has to do is listen to a lot of radio talk shows, you know, or even look at the journals of the right. I mean, they have really permeated. They have really managed, or Pat Robertson through his television stations, to really construct a substantial block of people in this country with certain views, most of them misinformed.
If the left, Joe, were somehow to adopt a more nuanced sense of what civil society is about, the kinds of pressures and influences it is under, beyond losing some of maybe its unjustified optimism about the possibilities and potential of oppositional action, what else might the left gain that could help its strategizing in its effort to combat some of this naked superpower aggression and hubris that all of us don't like?
Right. Well, maybe, you know, slowly we're learning, right? I mean, I've seen in talks by Al Franken and so on, an awareness that one has to combat directly this massive stream of misinformation and vitriol. I think we are seeing a greater appreciation of the need to undertake this task of addressing, first of all, the left intellectuals have to learn to address people in a manner that's more accessible. A lot of so-called leftist thinking is utterly inaccessible to even the educated individual. But I think we need to be aware and therefore then engage with greater effort, aware of the need to explain in accessible ways and through a direct confrontation with these forces, always knowing that we are at a disadvantage, of course, because, you know, as you know, business interests are at stake. I mean, the left does not have a Fox network and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, there is a need for better rhetoric, for more accessible thinking, for more direct addressing of these behaviors, you know, where the outlandish is fast becoming normal.
The voice of Joseph Buttigieg, his last name is spelled Buttigieg. We have a link to his book on our website, livingroomradio.org. He's a member of the Institute for European Studies at the University of Notre Dame, where he teaches English, among many other things. He's been editing and translating the prison notebooks of Antonio Gramsci. Volumes 1 and 2 cover Gramsci's notebooks 1 through 5. They are already out. Volume 3, covering at least notebooks 6 through 8, is due out in the summer of 2005. It's an incredible enterprise, Joe, with 29 notebooks in total. You were telling me that some notebooks, thankfully, are shorter than others. Why undertake it? What does it mean for you to edit and translate these documents, and what have you learned in the process?
Well, first of all, it's interesting. The reason I'm doing it is because my original intention was to produce a new and different selection of the notebooks from what already existed. And it was the late, unfortunately now late, Edward Said who insisted, no, you have to do the whole thing.
Interesting.
What is the purpose of it? Well, first of all, because Gramsci's work is a classic, as it were, for two areas of interest. First of all, how the modern state functions. You know, Gramsci is often quoted as if he were writing leftist strategy or something like that. No, Gramsci's first commitment was to understand how the state in modern society functions, the modern state. The second thing is that he has the most astute insight into the relationship between culture and politics. So those are the two areas in which his contribution is, I think, without equal among 20th century thinkers.
And as you have read his words, and you did so, I'm sure, well before you began this enterprise, What have you learned that may have surprised you, maybe specific points or emphases that you have found that people don't understand or appreciate about this man?
Right. The first thing that I found most striking when I came to the task of actually, you know, encountering his work so minutely, as it were, as to translate him, is the enormous attention that Gramsci always devoted to detail, to the particular. In other words, this is not a person who came with grand theories explaining everything, but rather, and this is instructive, I think, his approach was one of querying, of questioning. In other words, he starts by saying, look, we did not understand how fascism was going to take over. So how do we start studying in detail the specific case, not applying old and received grand theories? So this attention to the particular and the concreteness of his thinking. In other words, one of the things I believe has been somewhat unfortunate about leftist thought is precisely its abstract quality. And as I said earlier, this has led to a kind of distance between the leftist intellectuals and the larger population. And I think with Gramsci, one recognizes a masterful ability to think clearly and in very accessible ways. I should add, by the way, of course, that he was very well trained in this by virtue of his many years of journalistic writing prior to his imprisonment.
And yet, with all his attention to particulars and specifics, Gramsci's influence is really astounding. I was reading about his influence, say, in Latin America with many of the progressive movements there. What accounts for the fact that here is this man in Italy writing concrete things about particular events and thoughts, and yet his ideas have such widespread appeal?
Yeah, this is a question that's frequently asked. In fact, one could even broaden it and say, how come so many people talk about Gramsci when most Marxist thought has been consigned since 89 to the dustbin of history? No? I am absolutely convinced that there is one main reason for this. And that is when you start by analyzing the particular as opposed to bringing grand theories to bear upon phenomena around you, you are an exemplary undogmatic or even anti-dogmatic thinker. So unlike many other Marxist thinkers, Gramsci does not have a dogma. And this is also a part of the reason why he cannot be accused, for example, of being a totalitarian thinker. And so with the greater appreciation of the need to democratize everything, Gramsci always appears as a democratic thinker, although there have been those misrepresentations of the left who try to portray him as a totalitarian by saying, well, he was a Marxist, therefore he had he was totalitarian. Indeed, Gramsci also, by the way, in Europe, was very much a major influence during the period of Eurocommunism, when people were thinking that it was possible to have radical change without throwing out democracy.
We have just a couple of minutes left, Joe. And I'm going to ask you a pretty complex question, but let's try this.
Uh-huh.
To the extent that Gramsci is a Marxist thinker, what do you think was his most significant divergence from a Marxist thought?
Right. This is actually easy to answer because he was quite explicit about this. His divergence from Marxist thought was that he wanted to jettison the dogmatic aspect of Marxism. He inherited, as it were, or he was part of a legacy which regarded Marxism as having the answers to everything, you know, as knowing already where history is going. And Gramsci wanted to eliminate this and see Marxism more as a fundamental way of critiquing capitalist society. So again, this ties up with his anti-dogmatism. He departs from Marxism precisely on those grounds, that Marxism cannot be a dogma.
Joseph Buttigieg teaches English at the University of Notre Dame. We have a link to his edited and translated volumes of Antonio Gramsci's Prison Notebooks on our website, livingroomradio.org. Thanks very much for joining us today, Joe.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And William Walker is at the controls today. I want to thank him very much for his help. Chris Welch will be back in the host seat tomorrow. I want to announce a candidates forum, a forum in the Palo Alto area where listeners there can meet the candidates for the KPFA local station board and talk with them about their concerns. It happens tonight from 7:30 to 9:30 in Palo Alto at the Peninsula Peace and Justice Center, 457 Kingsley Avenue at Cowper. That's 7:30 tonight in Palo Alto at 457 Kingsley Avenue at Cowper. And this is CS suggesting that the important thing is not to stop questioning. Sasha is off this week and next. I will look for you on Monday.
The Monday through Wednesday editions of Living Room are produced by C.S. Sung and Sasha Lilly. Please visit our companion website, livingroomradio.org. And to make a comment or suggestion, drop us an email at livingroomradio@kpfa.org or call us at 510-848-6767, extension 209.